This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn. Today, an intriguing story of compounded error, confusion and death. Oddly enough, though it's about aviation, the teller of this amazing tale, this fascinating piece of sleuthing, is not an engineer, but an English teacher, Arthur Marcel from Queensland and the Queensland University of Technology, though he has, as you can tell, a deep interest in systems analysis and systems failure.
In this talk, I wish to use the story of a tragic aviation accident to illustrate a question for modern navigators. In the early afternoon of the 29th of November 1979, Air New Zealand Flight 901, a DC-10 aircraft codenamed November Zulu Pupa, on a scenic return flight to Antarctica, crashed into Mount Erebus, a 3,770-metre-high active volcano situated on Ross Island. All 257 passengers and crew were killed. Following the accident, there were two separate inquiries into why this five-year-old, perfectly airworthy aeroplane crashed. The first inquiry, conducted by the Air Accident Investigation Office of New Zealand's Ministry of Transport, found the cause of the accident to be pilot error. The second inquiry, a Royal Commission, completely reversed the first finding and laid total blame on the company and its management practices. It can be said that there were six distinct errors in the chain of events leading to this accident. The first one had been made more than a year before, when Air New Zealand began its Antarctica service. The error was made by the company's flight planners when they compiled the official standardised plan. To begin with, the final leg of the route was unusual. It was direct to McMurdo Station, an American ice airstrip on the southern side of Ross Island and directly behind Mount Erebus when approached from the north. This route was in distinct contrast to the usual military route, which took a dogleg around the mountain by flying up McMurdo Sound along the western side of the island. The error made by the flight planners was to give McMurdo Station a longitude coordinate that was more than 2 degrees out. The actual geographical position for that coordinate was almost 30 nautical miles to the west. Why was this mistake made? Perhaps the flight planners were inadvertently influenced by the longitude coordinate of the military route's dogleg corner, because the two longitudes were very similar. Whatever the reason, the error was to exist on the company's official Antarctic flight plan for about 14 months. It seems that there was never any attempt to proofread the flight plan coordinates against topographical reality. On the first Antarctic flights, McMurdo had been approached in visual conditions, and the crews had not strictly adhered to the flight plan route. Consequently, the error was not noticed until two flights before the accident flight. Once noted, it was reported back to the company's flight planning office. However, even with this advice, a correction was not immediately made. Perhaps it was thought to be a rather benign detail in that it put the company aircraft further away from the mountain. Even by the time of the pilot briefing for the fourth and fatal flight, the correction had not been made. This long delay in amending the plan was the second link in the chain. The third mistake came at the briefing itself 19 days before the flight, when no mention was made of this known error in the flight plan. Furthermore, the assigned crew, none of whom had been on this route before, were shown a cine presentation taken during a previous flight of a visual progression along a route very close to the military route. Also, the only maps given to the crew were a radio navigation chart showing the military route, a passenger information map also showing a flight path west of the mountain, and an advertising brochure which did the same. As well, the copies of the company's flight plan given to the crew members that day were the original version containing the longitude error. The assigned captain for the flight actually plotted the route on his atlas at home. It is not unreasonable to say that the crew members were given every cause to believe that their flight path would be well to the west of the mountain. The fourth error occurred at the briefing that day as well. The assigned crew were not briefed on the phenomenon of whiteout, a meteorological condition which obscures the horizon and blurs ground detail. This condition is a common one in the Antarctic and was to be a critical causative factor in the accident. The fifth mistake was made at about 1:40 on the morning of the flight. someone in the company flight planning office finally corrected the flight plan on the company's computer system. The longitude coordinate for McMurdo Station was now reconciled with topographical reality. The crew printed out a copy of this amended plan just before boarding the aircraft later that morning. However, there was no advice to the crew that the amendment had been made. They didn't even know that an amendment had ever been required. On the flight deck, the captain and first officer dutifully punched the coordinates for all the waypoints into their navigation system as the passengers were finding their seats. Neither noticed the innocuous change to the longitude for their destination waypoint, McMurdo Station. How would they see that two or three digits out of so many were different to the ones they had been given 19 days before? The navigation system in the DC-10 was a pre-GPS area inertial one, which plotted the aircraft's position directly from accelerative forces. The system only needed a starting point and could tell where it was simply from the aircraft's movements. Via the autopilot, it automatically steered the aircraft from one waypoint to the next. That morning, it was loaded with the correct geographical waypoint information in accordance with the company's corrected flight plan. For the first time in the history of Air New Zealand's Antarctic flights, the original flight planning error was not entered into the aircraft's navigation system. But that is not to say that the error no longer existed. It did still exist. It existed in the minds of the crew. They believed they were going to fly past Mount Erebus, 30 nautical miles on its western side, and not directly over it. The sixth and final mistake in the long chain of events occurred when the plane descended over the Ross Sea about 20 nautical miles north of Ross Island, then resumed a southerly course into Lewis Bay towards the mountain. The McMurdo controller had cleared the plane for a visual descent below their minimum safe altitude for non-visual flight. He had told the crew that they could expect 40 nautical miles visibility under the cloud cover. The captain elected to descend through a gap in the cover. The navigation system was disengaged and the aircraft made several descending turns. Then, under the cloud base and believing that they were still in visual conditions, the navigation system was locked back in and the aircraft resumed its programmed course. However, the pilots failed to realise they were in a whiteout situation under the cloud. They had a reasonably good horizon to the right, but they were now flying directly at a mountain which they saw more as an indistinct and obscured horizon rather than the sloping face of rock and ice it was. In the cockpit with the crew was one of New Zealand's most experienced Antarctic explorers. He was as deceived as they were. The visual cues approaching Lewis Bay were deceptively like those they expected to see entering McMurdo Sound, 28 miles to the west. They missed the only clue that they were in mortal danger available to them, this being the dropout in VHF radio communications with McMurdo Station caused by the mountain in between. However, they weren't happy with their situation. They were soon discussing a climb out. The first officer was suggesting a turn towards the clearer conditions on the right, and the flight engineer also expressed his apprehension. But several seconds later, they crossed the cliff-faced edge of the island, and the ground proximity system sounded a warning. They immediately initiated a go-round climb procedure, but even then, they probably didn't fully appreciate their dire situation. If they had fully reacted to the radar warning, they would have firewalled the engines and perhaps rotated the aircraft to a greater angle of climb. The fact that they followed a normal missed approach manoeuvre is a strong indication that they still believed they were clear of rising ground and testament to the trust they had in their navigation system. There was no panic. The flight engineer began reading out the falling numbers on the radar altimeter. The aircraft ploughed into the mountain 6 seconds later. So what is the question faced by modern navigators that this tragic accident illustrates? In broad terms, it is one of where and when, if ever, is it safe for a commander to relax or abrogate direct command responsibility to a vehicle's control, navigation and safety systems? This question actually predates aviation. In 1912, for instance, Captain Edward Smith sailed the Titanic at full speed through the night into an ice field, partly because he had been told that the ship was unsinkable. Clearly, he put too much trust in the system, in the same way the unfortunate pilots of November Zulu Pupa put too much trust in the system when they flew at low altitude into an area of visual uncertainty. Pilots, almost from their very first lesson, are taught to trust their instruments. Not to do so is far more likely to have fatal consequences, especially at critical moments when there is no time for reflection. For instance, on the night of the 1st of July 2002, a Swiss air traffic controller belatedly noticed a Russian airliner and a DHL cargo jet on intersecting courses at the same altitude. He immediately told the Russian pilot to descend below the other plane. The crews of both planes, however, were getting information from their automated collision avoidance systems, which, for the Russians, was a directive to climb. The Russian pilot had barely a minute to choose between the human controller telling him to descend and the onboard machine telling him to climb. Unfortunately, he put his trust in the human being and the two planes collided, tragically killing all on board. Interestingly, if there had been no automated system, there would have been no accident. Even if there had been no controller, the planes would probably have missed each other. The clear lesson from this accident, however, is that if there is an automated system, everyone, including air traffic control, must be in the loop, and everyone, without exception, must obey the system's directives. Flight and navigation instruments are becoming more and more sophisticated. These days, aircraft can find their way around, take off and land almost unassisted. The degree of automation is ever increasing. It is sometimes joked that the airliner of the future will have only two crew members, one being the pilot and the other being a dog. The pilot's job will be to feed the dog, and the dog is there to bite the pilot if he tries to touch anything. Perhaps the answer to the control conundrum partly lies in the fact that the sensors, in particular the eyes, are the final arbiters of all measurement systems, no matter how sophisticated they might be. As members of a primarily visual species, flight commanders are possibly better advised to trust their systems insofar as their eyes are not telling them to do otherwise. In descending below their minimum safe altitude, the pilots of November Zulu Pupa assigned primary responsibility for the safety of the flight to their visual perceptions, and hence it was they who were responsible for that final error. Certainly, this was the judgment of the Ministry of Transport's chief accident investigator, who found that the cause of the crash was the Air New Zealand captain's decision to continue the flight at low level towards an area of poor surface definition. Perhaps, though, the paradigms for determining who is in command, who is in direct control, and who is responsible are changing. The levels of complexity of modern transportation systems are such that the notion of the sole commander and his executive crew, all-powerful and totally responsible for the safety of the ship, a notion developed over many millennia of maritime and more lately of aerial navigation, is not as relevant as it used to be. We now live in an era of transportation systems in which many minds are involved in the operation of any particular vehicle, and the safe delivery of that vehicle to any particular destination can be seen as the product of systematic cooperation by a team of decision makers. There has to be trust at all levels for such systems to function properly. The pilots of modern aircraft have to place their trust in the organisation behind them for the system to work. The crew of November Zulu Pupa were let down by a system they not only had little option other than to trust, but one which they were given every conceivable reason to trust. In the paraphrased words of the Royal Commissioner, the cause of this accident was programming an aircraft to fly directly at a mountain and not telling the crew. Certainly, the pilots of November Zulu Pupa were directed into a very subtle trap, and even though it was they who took that sixth and final step, it's difficult to blame them for it.
Blame the system. Arthur Marcel teaches at the Queensland University of Technology and is interested in systems analysis, as you can tell. Next week, more flight, but this time, the flight of birds. The stories of John Gould and John Gilbert. I'm Robin Williams.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.